I'm delighted now to welcome to the program David Krakauer. He is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and he will be giving three lectures this week. It's a series called Cognitive Ubiquity, The Evolution of Intelligence on Earth. It's part of the Stanislav Ulam Memorial Lecture Series. That's tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday, August 30th and 31st and September 1st at the James A. Little Theater. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
So, can we define our terms? Like, what is intelligence?
I'm very reluctant to do it. I feel that definitions can be misleading. Right? They give you a false sense of understanding. And I'd much rather people came every night and were exposed to a rich set of phenomena and realized what intelligence meant in some sense by extracting from those lectures what I have in mind. Having said that, there is a long history of attempts to define it, and often for, at least to me, rather nefarious ends.
Like what?
Well, you know, the earliest investigations of intelligence start with people like Aristotle. I guess everything starts with Aristotle. And for Aristotle, intelligence was something extracorporeal, non-material, right? And so if you wanted to understand rational behavior, you couldn't understand it by looking at the body. And this was taken up by Thomas Aquinas in his Summa Theologica in the 13th century. And in the Summa, Aquinas argues that that non-corporeal, non-physical property is what links us to God. So the earliest investigations into intelligence were attempts to connect our own species to the divine. In the 16th century, Francis Bacon would have none of that. He thought, no, this is absolute nonsense. He had no time for scholasticism. And intelligence was all about using the evidence of your senses to understand the world. Early scientific revolution. But for none of those people did they bother defining intelligence. It wasn't critical to them. They assumed you knew what it meant and that it served particular social or ideological ends.
What are some of the social and ideological ends?
Well, typically it had to do with A, elevating the status of humanity above the rest of animate life. And so humans, unlike the rest of the beasts, have souls and they have reason and consequently should be given preferential privileged status. And that, of course, was extended to other members of our own species.
I was going to say some, perhaps the British are better than the Africans, savages, or things like that.
Exactly. And so, well, that's exactly right. And so that tendency really emerged in the 18th century. And so, and all sorts of stupid pseudo-scientific theories, anthropometry, physiognomy, craniometry, the cephalic index, all these big words that gave a scientific gloss to what was essentially racism. And the IQ test, and here, you know, the SAT test and so forth, grew out, actually, of those early psychometric tradition, the early attempt to give a number to what was essentially a prejudice.
And so there's still, I mean, if you take those kinds of tests, you're still working in that tradition?
Well, I think so. I think a lot of people feel that the having one number to sum up the totality of their life is not useful, and in fact acts as an impediment. When the IQ test was first invented by Binet in France, he invented it to help children who had learning disabilities. And so his objectives were quite noble. But then Henry Goddard, a eugenicist, an American, translated Binet, brought it to the US, and his reason for having an IQ test was to justify a process of sterilization of what he called the feeble-minded. He was concerned that America, the ultimate meritocracy, should only be comprised of super-intelligent people. And so, once again, it was essentially ideologically motivated, not scientifically.
So where are we now in terms of the way we understand and measure intelligence?
I think we're a little lost. I think it's an incredibly deep idea. In some sense, if you could argue, that it's a sort of the central organizing concept for our own species. Who are we? What makes us different from the rest of the world? What is our future? What is our relationship to intelligent machines? Is our lack of intelligence going to lead to our extinction? So it's a key concept to get right, and we understand that these numbers, psychometric numbers, don't much help to answer those questions. So I want to tell people, or let people know, that it's a very rich concept, And that, in fact, intelligence is present everywhere in the natural world, not just in our species.
Well, I was wondering whether intelligence is, if not synonymous with life itself, but integral to life itself, because if anybody survived the hundreds of millions or billions of years that life has been, how long has life been on Earth? 3-4 billion years?
Yes.
If anyone survived that mm-hmm. long, they mm-hmm. must have something going for
them. Well, actually, it's interesting you say that, because I think that the prototypical theory of intelligence that might surprise people is Darwin's theory. If you look at intelligence definitions, either they're stupid, so that which is measured by an intelligence test, right, or cryptic, the capacity to acquire capacities. Sort of take you up 4 hours to comprehend. In fact, most of them are things like the ability to behave flexibly, the ability to adapt to changing circumstance. And those are all, if you think about it, evolutionary perspectives. And so, in fact, I'll actually show that when Darwin created his theory of evolution, without him knowing it, he was actually creating the first real theory of intelligence.
Now, there are people who say dolphins are intelligent, mm-hmm. or my terrier is intelligent, mm-hmm. or my four-year-old is intelligent. Mm-hmm. Do those statements have anything in common?
I think they have a ton in common. All right, without defining it, you can ask, what are its essential ingredients? If I sat down with you and I said, look, let's hash out what we think we mean. Well, the first thing is, it has something to do with solving problems, right? Intelligence is related to the concept of difficulty. Things that are easily solved probably don't require it, and things that are difficult do. So you need a theory of difficulty, so that's one thing I'll do. And animals solve difficult problems all the time. Moving around a room, for example, right, is a very hard problem. If you've ever seen a robot that tries to navigate a crowded room, you'll understand how difficult it is. It's much harder than chess, for example, that computers effortlessly beat us at. So what is it? So I'm going to say that it's got three parts, and these might seem a bit daunting, but I'll try and explain what they are in the lectures. One is what's called strategy. That is, typically, intelligence behavior has a goal. You know, I want to pick up that glass, right? I want to put the ball in the net, and so on. Okay, that's strategy and how you do it. Another thing it has is what's called inference. And that can be things like learning and deduction, how you calculate something. Right? That's different from the goal. It takes you to the goal. Right? And the other part of it that's, in some sense, the deepest and most poorly understood is representation. That is, how we build in our mind's eye a model of the world that we use to solve problems with. And the best example of representation is the number system. Say, our own Arabic numbers or Roman numerals. That's a representation. And by using Arabic decimal numbers, there are problems that you can effortlessly solve, like adding two numbers together, whereas if you try to add or multiply in Roman numerals, it's fiendishly difficult. So those are the three components: strategy, inference, and representation. And all animals have those three capabilities to varying degrees, as do all the cells in your body. So the title of this lecture series, Cognitive Ubiquity, is flagging the idea that intelligence is absolutely everywhere and at all scales.
Your cells represent?
They absolutely do represent. And I'll give beautiful examples. I mean, your cells have perfect pitch. A single cell can calculate a frequency, for example. And so the cells in your brain are individually smart and collectively very smart.
What role does creativity play? In other words, where do you put creativity in the whole context of intelligence? To me, it seems like a really major part of the whole picture.
It is, and it's completely unsolved. It's something I struggled with, and so everyone recognizes it when they see it as somehow what Charles Peirce called abduction. That is the formulation of a genuinely new idea, right? Not just solving an idea someone else gave you. There is no theory, I think it's fair to say, that we have that can explain how new ideas come into existence. One approach to the problem is what's called generalization, and that is you solve a problem and then you're presented with a new one, and you realize that there's some fundamental connection between them. And that, in other words, you generalize from the problem that you solved. And that can be mathematized. But true creativity, that is, a problem that sort of springs out of nowhere is at present beyond science?
I was thinking there was... I went to a Santa Fe Institute lecture and the speaker was showing a termite house.
Yes.
And then showed a piece of a building by Gaudi, and they had a very similar structure. And it was, I mean, it's sort of cute, but it was talking about how in basically the model of natural selection built what ended up being the termite house, and a kind of human planning built what ended up being this cathedral or this building, which was a very similar shape. And I thought about it for a long time because that example was so intriguing and so rich to me. And I thought, you know, is the kind of intelligence that we have or the kind of creativity that builds a building or, I mean, makes a painting of a flower, makes a sculpture of a flower, in some way similar to the long evolutionary process that made the flower?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. I think the answer to that is yes, actually. There's a theory called the theory of niche construction, and that theory tries to explain why and how birds build nests or spiders build webs. And the internal, if you like, cognitive or mental steps that you have to go through to build a web are in some sense analogous to the steps that evolution had to go to build the web. The difference is, and I'll explain this, evolution is very inefficient. The way it solves problems essentially is by killing organisms.
Right.
You have large populations of individuals, they differ in some way, and the ones that survive have the right answer, right? And the ones that die do not. So if you wanted to remember your mum's name, by an evolutionary process, you'd have to have 1,000 of you. Each of you would have a different name in your brain, and 999 that got it wrong would die, and the one who did know the name was survived. That doesn't really work very well. So what we've done is we've built brains with lots of cells, and those lots of cells are analogous to the many individuals in a population. And what dies as you form ideas are hypotheses. So there's a very intriguing correspondence, as you point out, between the long history of evolution and the shorter history of learning. But instead of individuals dying, ideas die.
And so the structure of our brains is, in a way, a representation of that long process of evolution.
Exactly. Evolution has found ingeniously a way to sort of, if you like, cut itself out of the picture. It's given us a way of circumventing itself. And so there's a little mini evolution that goes on in each of our brains in our lifetime.
We're talking to David Krakauer, professor at the Santa Fe Institute, about his lecture series, which is coming up tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday night. So let's talk for a moment about some of the differences, and I don't know if you want to call this intelligence, but the fundamental differences between human intelligence and all these other incredibly intelligent species like wolves and dolphins and chimps and so on. I mean, they don't have, as far as I know, science or epistemology or you know, sophisticated art making or music making even. There's some music making.
Yes. No, this is a very challenging problem. And one way to answer it, to demonstrate the full extent of our prejudice right, and anthropocentrism, is to talk about human activity for a second. So most people would agree that someone who solves a hard math problem is very smart. Now, you might say, oh, they're mathematically smart. They're not emotionally smart, but you'd say they're smart. On the other hand, if an incredible athlete solves a problem on the football field or on the basketball court, you'll typically say, well, that's not intelligence, that's just talent. Now, I'm here to tell you that from the point of view of the brain, that's a spurious distinction. The brain doesn't make those distinctions. We do. And so what is the difference here? Well, one difference is one feels unconscious, right? And the other feels conscious.
Why does the sports thing feel unconscious?
Well,
what do you mean by that?
I mean the following. If you're playing tennis and someone serves a ball at you over 100 miles an hour, you respond reflexively. After years of training, you've learned, your sort of body has learned how to solve the problem. Whereas if you're given a math problem, even after tens of years of studying math, you still have to sort of reason it through. And so one of the things I'm going to claim in these lectures is that true intelligence is about moving the problem from the part of your brain that has to reason about it often very inefficiently, to a part of the brain that can do it almost unconsciously. Right? Now, so we already make that distinction between different activities in our own species. Now, to look at other species, bat echolocation or swimming in the cetaceans, it's extraordinary. It uses unbelievable, makes incredible demands on their brains, right? As great as the demands made in our brains by solving math problems. But we don't call it intelligent for the same reason that we don't call swinging a tennis racket intelligent. But the distinction is not real neurally. There is a distinction, and it's an interesting one, but it's not about intelligence.
What's it about?
Okay, so what is it that humans do that's different? And I think many people have argued that what makes humans special is language, that we can assign symbols to objects and string them together to make sentences and so forth.
But then it turns out prairie dogs do
that. Well, right, and then, that's right, and bees do it with their waggle dance, and birds do it, but to a much lesser degree. So it becomes, if you like, a quantitative rather than a qualitative distinction. But one thing that humans do, and I'll talk about this quite a lot in Lecture 2, is that they can externalize their intelligence. So, for example, if you try and play chess blindfolded, it's really hard. Actually, my grandfather was a chess master, and he could do it blindfolded, and he'd destroy me blindfolded, right?
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, whereas having a chessboard in front of you somehow acts as what we would call a working memory. It sort of supplements your memory, so you no longer have to remember where the pieces are. The board remembers. And that's true for your computer. Your computer stores things so that you don't have to store them. But it does.
Yeah, my friend calls his iPad his exobrain.
It is. It's exact. But he's actually literally right.
Yeah.
But unlike a chessboard, a computer can do something else too. It can actually compute. It can actually perform arithmetic on its own memory. So it's inferential, according to that earlier remark. So humans have this remarkable ability to externalize their intelligence. And in fact, I would say that's the largest part of human intelligence. If you think about taking a human being, putting them out of culture at birth, and seeing how they fared in competition with the wolves you mentioned, my estimate would be that they wouldn't do very well. What we do incredibly well is absorb all of this external knowledge that's stored in culture and manipulate it using our brain. So there is a distinction, because these animals don't externalize cognition, but the distinction is not necessarily just in the raw brain power. It's this additional facility we have, which is remarkable and very poorly understood.
One of the things that comes to mind when you talk about the distinction between somebody on the sports field and somebody who's solving math problems is that the person who solves math problems can eventually use that knowledge to build buildings and cars and all these feats of human technology, whereas that's not true of the sports person. And so it seems to be a kind of more human,
more generalizable, to use that word, right?
Yeah, and more right. Like more about really changing your environment.
You know, it's a very interesting observation. I think that's true. It's not true for all knowledge, and certainly there are specialized domains of knowledge where it's very hard to imagine what their utility is beyond demonstrating high intelligence. But you could argue
like chess.
Well, like chess, for example, right? Chess, being good at chess makes you good at chess. I think that, and very bad socially, it could be that being really good at one sport generalizes to other sports. Most people who are gifted physically in one domain are gifted in another. So there is some generalization.
But still, even if you're good at all sports, that doesn't build you a skyscraper.
It doesn't. No, I think you're right. But that gets back to my earlier remark about externalization of knowledge. I think where I agree with you, building a skyscraper requires an architect's plan, right? It requires, moreover, collaboration over the externalized knowledge. Because once I put it out there, you can contribute to it. So there's this collective contribution that other animals don't have access to, which makes us appear so much smarter than we are. I mean, the way I joke about this is, you know, 99.9% of everything I know, I got from everyone else. I didn't. My
right.
contribution to the world in terms of knowledge is absolutely minimal, right? And it's because I can look at that external knowledge and add incrementally to it. And that's something that other animals can't do as well. And as you say, we don't do physically.
We're talking to David Krakauer, professor at the Santa Fe Institute. What about things like bees and beehives and things like that? I mean, they build things, and they've got all sorts of collective activity going on.
That's true. And so that would be... So this is another very important point that you're raising, and that is that as a Darwinian, as I am, an evolutionary person, I don't want my idea of intelligence to be restricted to a single species, because I believe, and I have good evidence to support it, that most traits are present in some form in multiple species. Right? And so I think you're absolutely right to point out that these niche-constructed traits, like webs or nests, have some glimmer of the externalization of symbols that we engage in. But there is a very important distinction, and that is that when we externalize abstract concepts often, and they're making manipulations to the physical world, not to the sort of conceptual space. So I don't want to deny that there's some interesting continuity there, but I think there is a qualitative difference.
One of the things that you find in nature is that wild animals tend to be, and in fact I think are always, considerably more intelligent than genetically similar or genetically identical domesticated animals. So wolves are smarter than dogs and so on.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think one of the problems with that is you probably have to define intelligence, or define, if you like, or establish a set of criteria or tests where those measurements could be made. And I think, in a way, what you're asked, you might say, well, look, a dog would always be beaten by a wolf in a competition. But that's probably not the correct comparison.
No, but there, I mean, I got this from Daniel Dennett when he was here talking about wild and domesticated religions, and we had a conversation about that. But, I mean, it's not just because they're bigger, but they're much more likely to survive in nature, wolves, that is, than domesticated dogs. I mean, this is maybe trivial, but I observe my own dogs and their ability to even find food that's fallen on the floor.
No, but that's exactly my point. The comparison you're making is a simple competitive comparison. I think that exactly the same would apply to us if we were placed in competition with a chimpanzee.
Right.
So, and I think that's right, and I think that is an interesting measure of intelligence. On the other hand, in competition over a chessboard, we'd win it. And you might say, well, that's ludicrous or laughable. But I think that's the true distinction. And I think with domesticated animals, where they might win is that they've been trained to respond very sensitively to human impulses. And I suspect that on human-oriented, almost empathy tests, they would outperform the wild varieties. So I think one would it gets to this issue always in this discussion of intelligence, of defining in what way you want to measure it.
Well, and as somebody, who was it who pointed this out, there's a lot more domestic dogs than wolves.
Yeah.
They've figured out how to survive by making these niches in our houses.
That's right. We're enslaved by them. That's right.
So your first lecture, the one tonight, is called The Adversarial Quartet. What's that all about?
Well, it's interesting. I was saying that you intuited that idea in some of your early questions. That is that intelligence is, in some sense, in our lifetime, analogous to evolution over multiple lifetimes. And there's a series set of mathematical ideas or theories that all look very similar. It turns out that Skinner, if you remember, worked on conditioning. You know, he would
B.F. Skinner, the psychologist.
The psychologist would put a little box, would create a box, and train a pigeon to press a lever by rewarding it when it performed a correct behavior. And it turns out that if you mathematize that, it looks just like Darwin's theory of evolution. The difference being, instead of selecting organisms, you're selecting behaviors. Game theory is another theory associated with John von Neumann, who worked on the Manhattan Project. And that tries to explain how you behave strategically, how you outwit someone else in a competition, for example. And there, the theory is the selection of strategies. So all of these theories are all about the selection of something. And it turns out when you mathematize it, they all converge on a similar structure. And so it seems that they had all discovered, in some sense, some essential ingredients, what I consider the intelligence process, that in fact transcends any one of those theories on their own. And that's what I call the adversarial quartet.
So another one of your lectures is about machines. So what does intelligence mean in a machine? I mean, okay, the computer sitting in front of me right now can outcompute me, can outcompute anybody by a factor of a gazillion to one.
Depends what it's doing. Well, there are ways in which that can be just pathetic. Ask it to go and get you a cup of coffee.
Right. But I mean, in terms of like mathematical computation.
But even then, so this is interesting. So what is it about computers? So if you think about tools that we build, they typically have a specialized purpose, right? So, you know, like a screwdriver does what a screwdriver does, and a hammer, and a book does what a book does, and a chess set does what a chess set does. What makes computers very intriguing is that they can do all of that. They have the property that Alan Turing, the great pioneer of the theory of computation, called universality. And so Alan Turing discovered in the 30s that anything that could be written down, that could be solved just by implementing rules, what we call algorithms, could be performed by a computer. And in that sense, they resemble a brain, because that's what a brain can do. You know, a brain can sing a song, it can move your legs, it can solve a math problem, it can hold a tennis racket. All of these are what we call rule-based activities. And computers are the only tool we've ever built that have that critical capability. And so that's the first important point, this concept of universality. However, when it comes to problem solving, they have none of our general purpose intelligence. Everything that you would think was really clever that a computer did is super specialized. And so, you know, Google search engine does search. Chess computers play chess. I have a little poster in my office, and it says, Garry Kasparov beats Deep Blue in one move. If you remember, Deep Blue beat Kasparov in a famous chess tournament. And it has a picture of Kasparov at the wall socket turning off the power to Deep Blue. Right? That's the one.
Deep Blue is a machine.
Deep Blue is a machine, yeah. Deep Blue is a computer built by IBM to play chess. And so this is the point.
So the one move was unplugging it.
Unplug the damn thing, you know. And so that's gets to this idea of general purpose, flexible intelligence. And one of the great, if you like, I think almost tragedies of science is that there's been an emphasis on creating machines that solve specialized problems, which they do very well, to the neglect of thinking hard about machines that can solve very general and multiple problems. And so machine intelligence is very backward. A lot of people exaggerate how far we've come, but we've only come far in this very specialized sense.
I suppose it's easier to get a machine to solve a specialized problem than to solve a generalized problem.
Much, much, much easier. And there is actually a mathematical theory for that, and I'll try and present that in a very... I was being reprimanded before this program began by Mary Charlotte to make things clear.
No, but you always make things clear. I was saying that some, ladies and gentlemen, some of David Krakauer's colleagues in the world of science speak science jargon even on the radio from time to time, and it's hard for us laymen and women to understand what they're saying, but you're extremely clear.
No, thank you. But I think you're right. There's a challenge to try and explain to people why machines aren't very smart. And there is actually a mathematical theory which one can present just with pictures, which will give people an insight into why computers are so good at chess but so bad at making a cup of tea.
So let's talk about the word. I mean, we've talked about intelligence, we've talked about creativity. What about just thinking?
It's interesting. I think that because the concept is so poorly defined, there's a constellation of concepts that are all so closely related, it's almost not worth making the distinction. I think people typically reserve the word thinking for, if you like, the process of computing a solution, right? And I'm using, notice, a computational metaphor, machine metaphor, because we don't have other metaphors, which is a problem. So I think, but thinking also, I think, has the connotation of deduction, if you like, symbol manipulation, that form of reasoning, as opposed to moving, where I think a lot of people would be reluctant to say, because I walk from one side of the room to the other, I was thinking. They might think while they walk, but they're not thinking by walking, which is unfortunate because you are.
In fact, a lot of times you think better when you walk.
Right, but that's different, right? And it's just a mystery to me why we we exclusively apply these kinds of concepts to a very circumscribed domain of neural activity, which is very rarefied, say mathematics or reasoning, and not to all the incredible things our nervous system does.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people, if you say, what are you doing? I'm thinking about the problem that my kid is having in school. And yes. What am I going to do about that? Or how does she feel? Or whatever. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that people call thinking.
Yeah, okay, so you're saying that's an instance of a non-formal kind of thinking.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's still symbolic and linguistic. It's not emotion. I mean, I actually feel, you know, another way to put this is, I mentioned these three ingredients in inference, strategy, and representation. Now, I'll give you another example of something that's, for me, deep thinking that doesn't get called thinking, and that's art. Art is fundamentally representational. And if you ask what were the revolutions in art, they'll typically be revolutions in representation, right? So pointillism or cubism or abstract expressionism. They all relate to different ways of representing the world. They emphasize different features of the world. So I think there's a deep affinity there between what artists are doing in trying to represent the world they see and what the brain is doing when it's trying to represent problems in the world.
Well, and there's also... Mm-hmm. A body of literature, I mean, I don't know how far you can take this, I haven't really analyzed it myself, but that really makes a case that a lot of cutting-edge art historically has been prescient of the scientific movements that follow closely on their heels.
Absolutely, or coincident with it. A lot of work on the early 20th century and the emergence of avant-garde, or if you like, non-melodic musics in jazz or in the classical, Stravinsky, for example, non-representational art in cubism, and some very brain-challenging ideas like Einstein's theory of relativity, all being coincidence and quantum mechanics, that somehow a new concept of causality and representation was emerging in culture generally, not just in the sciences or the arts.
Do you, as scientists at the Santa Fe Institute, do you work with artists as a way of, or have you thought about that as a way of opening up your kind of brain to theirs and using the synergy of those ways of thinking?
Absolutely. In fact, it's something speaking for myself, I do a lot. I've been very, very fortunate at the Institute and in this town to meet extraordinary artists. I mean, you know, I just had dinner the other night with James Drake, who's a local artist with a great interest in science, extraordinary representational gift. We have at the Institute two writers, Cormac McCarthy and Sam Shepard, both of whom are friends, and both of whom have incredible representational capabilities. I've worked with the Santa Fe Symphony.
And so right, that's right.
Right, and so I feel at some deep level, once we overcome our biases about what we think intelligence is, we're going to see much deeper connections between the arts and the sciences.
And with any luck, collaborations.
And collaborations, absolutely.
Now, let's get back to the whole concept of machines thinking or not thinking or doing computation and how limited that is. We obviously have not begun to really understand the human brain, but is it just a matter of time until we're able to represent the brain fully and make a computer that is analogous to it?
Yeah, I think, okay, this is a hard one. And so this is a prognostication discussion, and I'm sort of into it. So there have been some extraordinary trends in computing technology. These sometimes are called scaling laws. Moore's law is the one that most people might have heard of, and that's the idea that the number of transistors on a chip is doubling every 2 years. And this means that the cost of manufacturing a computer is decreasing exponentially, whereas their power is increasing exponentially. And some people have claimed that those exponential trends will lead to what's called a singularity, that there'll be a point, and I think Ray Kurzweil, who is often associated with this idea, has estimated that sometime around 2040 or 50, our intelligence will be eclipsed by machine intelligence simply because of these scaling laws. They'll have so many transistors, it'll be so cheap to manufacture, that they'll just outwit us. Now,
Yeah, then you get into science fiction.
Well, you know, as you said, science fiction is often the sort of wavefront of science, and so I think there are some interesting ideas hiding in here. One of the problems with computers that are different from brains, and I'll talk about this a lot, I think it's probably the fundamental weakness, is that they don't have the cognitive ubiquity property.
And what is that?
Okay, so we have super smart cells in our body. Every neuron is a little bit like a yeast. Every little neuron cell, brain cell, in our brain behaves a little bit as if it was a free-living organism. And if you look at videos, as I'll show, of the development of the brain, they're swimming about as if they were little slugs. Okay. A computer is very different. A computer has totally inert, uninteresting components, gates or transistors. And we assume that just by putting lots and lots and lots of them together, you'll get something super intelligent. I call that the strong emergence hypothesis, that intelligence will emerge if we put enough dumb stuff together. The weak emergent hypothesis, which I favor, says you put a lot of not so smart stuff together, then you get something really smart out. And I think there's going to have to be a fundamental change in the way that engineers build computers to make them truly intelligent in that general purpose way that we discussed. They're going to have to start building computers out of computers.
If you look at society as an analogy, there's a lot of smart people in society, but societies don't often act in a very smart way.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that's it's absolutely true. It goes against what I said earlier, right? So most of the intelligence in our species is in society. In other words, it's in culture, it's in libraries, it's in film, it's in music. On the other hand, on short time scales, if you put a lot of people together, they can appear unbelievably stupid, for example, in crowds. So what I'm talking about is this ability to preserve the best of, in other words, have a memory that over multiple generations can accrete great ideas. I think at any one point in time, when you put enough people together, you're right, you might get a stupid answer.
What is the relationship between intelligence and humor?
Oh, that's a tricky, tricky one. In the 1950s, I mentioned Alan Turing earlier, and he was this wonderful pioneer in machine intelligence. And he, I'll talk about this in lecture three, decided to set an exam that would measure the IQ test of a computer. And that exam, or test, is called now, by us, the Turing test. Okay. And the Turing test consists in having a terminal that you type at, and there can either be behind it a computer program or a real human. And your job is to determine whether you're talking to a human or to a computer. And I'll show lots of transcripts of these conversations that people have with computers, and they're genuinely hilarious because many of these computers come across as if they've been smoking too much of something. Okay. But Daniel Dennett, who you mentioned earlier, made a very interesting remark. He said, the real test of a clever computer is when it laughs at a joke.
Right.
And I think that why that seems very compelling, and the question is why. And I think it's because jokes are, first of all, incredibly associative. They require not specialist knowledge, but true generalist knowledge. And they're also embodied. They're in the world. They refer to your being in the world. And I think that is exactly what computers don't have. And I think it's a very interesting concept.
They also make connections between things like sounds of words or things that aren't normally associated.
Right. And those are exactly those specialist algorithms are not very good at picking up. You can certainly build a sort of sham intelligence so that every time you typed in something, it would laugh. It would type out the word ha ha ha.
Right.
But you'd quickly realize that there was something deeply flawed in the computer you were interacting with.
Let's go back a moment to evolution, pre-human evolution, and the evolution of intelligence. Before we went on the air today, you started talking about some of the qualities that naturally emerge as beings become complex and become more intelligent, and one of them is number sense.
Yes.
What do you mean by that? Like just the sense of 1, 2, 3, 0? I don't know if any other animals have zero. Many.
Yes.
How's it work?
So as I said earlier, there has been an emphasis on language as the defining human characteristic, And I think that's not wrong, but there are other things that we do symbolically that are equally impressive that might be pre-linguistic, and one of them is counting. And so you could imagine if you are a rhesus monkey and you're living in a forest, it would make sense to be able to determine that the other troop across the way had more individuals in it than yours, right? You don't have to communicate, but being able to count would be very useful, adaptively.
Do you think they count or just have a sense of where there's a big group?
No, they count. So in the last 10 years, there have been a series of extraordinary experiments, and I'll talk about this in lecture two, where they've demonstrated that not only do they count, but they also know ordinal relationships, larger than and less than, and they can perform arithmetic. And we not only do we know that, but we now understand where in the brain that's encoded and how. And the truly remarkable thing that we discover is that humans are not much better at it than rhesus monkeys. If you look at just what's called numerosity, our ability to represent number. So I show you some set of objects on the table and I ask you, are there more here than there and so forth and how many? And there are cells that actually count. There are cells that have represent the number 22, for example, in our brain. So, yes, they would have a number. And we're not much better at representing that number than them, but what we can do is we can externalize the number. We can write that number on paper symbolically. And what that means for us is something like the following. Adding one and one in your brain is actually no easier or harder than adding a million and a million. They're both two something.
Right.
But for a monkey, adding one and one is much, much, much easier than adding a million and a million. It can't do it.
Right.
So we've found a way of turning very big numbers using an external representation into tiny numbers and using what is basically our very simple-minded arithmetic brain to solve very complicated mathematical problems.
It's also true that we have, I think it's one of the problems that turns into a political problem, is that people don't really have any visceral sense of the difference between a trillion and a billion. So when they start talking about budget deficits, it gets confusing.
But that's a very good point, because we don't internally, we can't represent those numbers.
Yeah.
And it's only when someone writes it down with a one with a ton of zeros after it that we begin to realize how much bigger it is.
Yeah, but it's just three more zeros, and we don't have, I suppose we don't have really an analogy in nature.
No, there isn't. There is no, we have a notion of powers of 10, if you like, or orders of magnitude, and that doesn't exist in nature. And it comes to us through our mathematical representation of number. Roman numerals don't have it naturally, but Arabic numerals do, because we understand that the contribution of the one gets bigger the more zeros it has after it.
There's something I've always wondered, and you'd be the man who knows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so life started somewhere between 3 and 4 billion years ago, mm-hmm. and human life is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of that.
Yes.
But there have been millions and millions of species on Earth, and many of them complex species. So the principle of evolution, namely mutation that leading to natural selection, I mean, the number of useful mutations that then make their way into the gene pool for a species, as opposed to the, you know, like you were talking about, the hypotheses that die or the
yes.
mutations that die. Is there a calculation for that, for 3 or 4 billion years corresponding to the amount of complexity that we really have? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. It's interesting you asked this question. So let me try and restate it a little bit.
Yeah, restate it, because yeah. for our listeners.
No, it's a hard one. And I think what you're saying is, in some sense, how many calculations did evolution have to perform to get the answers that we see, where the answers are the life that we observe? That's what you're saying, in a way. Which would be
And how long did those take?
And how long did they take? Right. Okay, that's very interesting. And it's something I'm deeply interested in my own research. So here's a fact that might surprise people. So, you know, the Earth is, as you say, about 4.6 billion years old. The first life that appeared on Earth, single-celled life, bacteria essentially, took about 800 million years to come into existence. So to go from non-living just volcanoes and so on, to little swimming cells, 800 million years. To go from those cells, bacterial cells, to what are called eukaryotic cells, the cells that make us up and plants, that took 2 billion years. Much harder to create the cells that we have in us than to make life. To go to a jellyfish from those eukaryotic cells took, just under a billion years again. And then to create a human from a jellyfish was about 500 million years. So in other words, once you've got a jellyfish, you've got a human. But if you have a bacterium, you don't necessarily have a fungus for a long time. So the way I put this is, from the point of view of searching for life elsewhere, intelligent life elsewhere, if you go to a planet and find a little single-celled bacteria, that might be all you find, right? Because it takes such a long time to move on from there. But if you found a teeny little sluggy jellyfish thing, well, then you've probably got a high probability of finding something much more complicated. And people, I think, tend to think that it took much longer to create us, really yeah. smart stuff, than to create the stupid stuff, and it's the absolute opposite.
And why is that?
Well, it gets to my earlier remark about how are intelligent systems really made. And my claim, and admittedly, I'm not sure many people would share it at this point, is that intelligent systems are made by combining many, many rather intelligent cells. And so once we had these special eukaryotic cells, it was really only a matter of scale. It was aggregating them. And if you aggregated enough of them, you got the intelligence we see as uniquely human.
We're talking to David Krakauer, professor at the Santa Fe Institute. So, not to end on a worrisome note or anything, but if we continue to externalize our intelligence and make these machines, and maybe these machines will be not only made of circuits and stuff, but they'll be biological and so on, are we under any kind of threat? I mean, obviously that's a totally sci-fi question, but what do you think?
Well, I think there are... I like thinking about those problems. I like sci-fi. And so I think there are two answers to this. One is that we build a machine that treats us the way we treat the rest of life on Earth. In which case... In which case, the future is rather gloomy. But I actually have a more gloomy short-term scenario. And that is that we build a tool, unlike any other tool that we've built before, of such incredible universal power of the kind I described in relation to Turing. And we're so ethically challenged, we're so fundamentally unintelligent, that we deploy that tool in a way that leads to our demise.
Now, you're not just talking about thermonuclear bombs or climate change.
I'm talking about all of those machines that we increasingly use to organize our lives. Our lives are now gradually shifting into a machine memory. Our friendships, our correspondences, the way that governments wage war, all the way at all of those scales. And I think that we're unable to think sensibly about how to engage with those universal tools. So in the short term, I think it's not the gloomy matrix scenario where humans are turned into batteries, but where we're so unable to understand the world that we've created that it falls apart without us being able to intervene.
David Krakauer is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and once again, he will be giving three lectures this week, tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday. The series is called Cognitive Ubiquity, The Evolution of Intelligence on Earth. It's part of the Stanislav Ulam Memorial Lecture Series. So it's at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe at 7:30. Santa Fe Institute is on the web at santafe.edu. David Krakauer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for indulging me.